Thanks for listening to Pod of Jake. I'm Jake. You can reach me anytime by emailing jake@blogofjake.com. I'm fortunate to have some sponsors supporting the show whose products I genuinely love and recommend. I'll start with a word on those so the rest of the episode will have no interruptions. I hope you enjoy. This episode is brought to you by Levels. Levels uses continuous glucose monitoring to track your blood sugar in real time. It allows me to see the impact that everything I do has on my metabolic health so that I can optimize my diet and exercise accordingly. Wearing the Levels patch, I feel like I'm living in the future. There's this moment when you raise your phone to the back of your arm, it vibrates and shows your glucose level right on the screen. It's this instantaneous look inside yourself, an in-the-moment snapshot of what's going on inside your body. And while it's only showing one simple measurement for now, it's enough for me to see the future. And that's exciting. It's exciting because I believe that we can live meaningfully longer and healthier lives than we do today, and I believe technologies like Levels will help us to get there. Levels is currently running an exclusive beta program with a waitlist of over 100,000 people, but you can skip the line and join Levels today by using my link in the show notes, levels.link/Jake. Again, that's levels.link/Jake. This episode is brought to you by Aura. That's Oura. The Oura Ring, from my perspective, is the single best wearable on the market. I use it to measure my sleep, activity, and readiness on a daily basis. I bought my Oura Ring several months ago before talking with the company's CEO on the podcast. I haven't taken it off since. I believe what gets measured gets managed. So if you care at all about your health, which you should, you have to measure your sleep in order to manage it. Oura measures much more than just my time in bed. It tracks my REM sleep versus deep sleep, my resting heart rate and heart rate variability, my temperature, my activity, and much, much more. For $299, you can get your own Oura Ring on auraring.com. That's auraring.com. Auraring.com. Okay, let's get into it. Thank you, Andrew, for coming on and joining me on the show today. I really appreciate you taking the time. You are the co-founder and CEO of Skiff, a privacy-first, end-to-end encrypted email collaboration and file sharing product. And some of those features are pretty new. I used the product a couple months ago and was basically using it for like Google Docs with comments and checking out the website in anticipation of this call. I realized you guys have rolled out email. The whole thing looks a lot different, and it's very cool, and looking forward to talking about things. But before we get into all that, I would love to start by just getting your background and hearing your story for those who don't know you and those who don't know Skiff. And, as early as you're willing to start, the better.
Absolutely. And yeah, thank you so much, Jake, for having me on. I really appreciate it. So I guess not unlike many of your guests, I think I started programming when I was really, really young. And it's just for generation after generation gotten much and much easier with programming toys and classes and all sorts of stuff. I started really young, probably, around 5 years old with stuff related to FIRST Robotics. And so I got introduced to the basic concepts of, building robots that compete at simple tasks, with programming them to follow lines, to move around, and to just basically move things from one place to another. But, I basically then started doing my own engineering projects for the following decades and ended up just really enjoying building things in the physical world, from flight simulators to small autonomous cars. Eventually that brought me to do computer science competitions, robotics, and just my own engineering a lot when I was a teenager and in high school. I grew up in New York City. And then, that facilitated a whole transition to studying computer science at Stanford, running actually Stanford's hackathon with Skiff's co-founder. He kind of planned all of our design back a few years ago, and we had an idea we would later start a company together. And then eventually into programming jobs and internships at SpaceX and all sorts of other awesome places. So definitely really early roots in general programming. But I really kind of ended up following this passion more towards, human safety and security and collaboration with design.
Yeah, it's interesting. I've heard certainly a lot of, guests on the podcast started coding quite young. I don't know if I've heard 5 years old, though. That's pretty early working with robots and things like that.
Well, I truly mean it. It gets easier and easier. Like if you have gone into Apple stores and you see, elementary school coding classes, and there are these amazing pushes by, code.org and other organizations to get computer science in every US elementary school. And so it's pretty awesome to see that kids are getting exposed to all of these concepts. And I think with the right few fundamentals of, how does a basic programming language, how would you write instructions in it? I think that is can be a game changer. Not even in giving you years of advanced knowledge, but just making you kind of much more curious about it from an early age. So I think that's awesome. And who knows? I don't know if the entirety of American society needs to be engineers and programmers, but we're definitely seeing a lot of kind of young students and kids exposed to it, which is cool.
Right. And so I guess growing up in New York, just as like an aside point, that's a pretty unique experience. I grew up somewhere near New York, and sort of that was like my main city though. And I always thought it was a bit funny to like, my closest city, like if you live in, Ohio or something, like your closest city might be Cleveland, let alone somewhere outside the US in some totally remote place. But just happening to be born in like New York or around New York, it's like this weird thing where your city is like the biggest city in the world. Do you think that had any like did that like help your development at all, or impact your development in any way?
That's a really interesting question. And I'm curious if you have thoughts on the opposite answer, being outside a city. So what I like to say is, 8 million people live in New York, so someone has to grow up there. And it was me and whatever other students doing finding all sorts of things to do. And I think it just, it definitely played some role where I was exposed to a lot of people and parents and things that were either technical or, really kind of computer science focused. So, my dad was an engineer up to a PhD. My mom, ended up getting involved in a lot of the engineering activities me and my sibling did. And she, doesn't work in engineering, but has some technical experience. And I would also see that in, friends' parents who were engineers who, worked in finance or who, worked for the city or worked for like major shipping companies and airlines and all sorts of stuff. So there was definitely a lot of exposure to that. And finally, I think New York just has everything. So, I remember going to like little robotic stores and, collaboration clubs when I was in elementary school. And so if you basically want it, you can kind of find it. And so I think that definitely played a role. Yeah, I don't know. I think, I'd love to hear what are your thoughts on people who grew up. I know you've talked to people all around the world, and I'm wondering, like, do you feel like there's a theme of big cities just having these opportunities, or is it just, diverse and everyone finds their own path?
Yeah, it's an interesting question. I think it seems to me that it's mattering less and less. Obviously, growing up in a super urban area is a bit different in a lot of ways than growing up in a very rural area, sort of regardless of where you're from. But people all over the world are just plugging in online, and who they follow on Twitter is just as important as who their neighbors are. And obviously, from a very young age, like before you sort of plug in online, although people are plugging in earlier and earlier, your parents have a larger impact than your friends and teachers and parents of your friends and things like that. But it seems to me that the playing field is evening out a bit, and that will be probably really good for people in, developing countries, or just generally internationally, and maybe not so good for people, like us born in the US, or even on the more extreme side of things, people born in or growing up around San Francisco and New York and things like that. But for now, I think I certainly consider it having been helpful to have sort of grown up in this area. A lot going on, a lot of people very ambitious, and fortunate to have some good network and things like that. And I think the same sounds like it was somewhat true for you. So yeah, I think long story short, playing field's evening, but still it's sort of advantageous to grow up in any place with like a lot of energy and people doing interesting things. Transitioning on the point of interesting things a little bit, you talked about working on flight simulators, I think you said, and autonomous cars. I saw on your website there's like some sort of video in the background. What's can you, do you know what that is? Can you tell me a little bit about that if you remember?
So I worked on a bunch of different, honestly, very autonomous vehicle focused projects for the first 20 something years of my life. So I built some little navigating GPS guided cars, nothing like a Waymo or a Zoox or a big car like that, but just something that could navigate around. And then eventually got really into just kind of autonomous aircraft, high altitude balloons, and stuff that would just go really high in the atmosphere and take pictures. And so this was around the time I also had the awesome opportunity to be an intern at SpaceX and work on their crew capsule. And so I think that's just an awesome context for doing engineering. You're thinking about this device that's going to go up into the air and to be, exposed to all sorts of different temperatures and pressures and altitudes and conditions. And so, doing engineering when it would affect like this the safety of the device or the occupants is just so meaningful and deep. And I think in many ways it has led to a great transition to Skiff, where we think a lot about, our users and making sure that their every single piece of their personal information is owned by them. And when they communicate, they own their own data and they can speak freely and work privately. And I think that same mentality that you think of when you're doing engineering in such circumstances really feels quite similarly.
Yeah, and we'll definitely talk about Skiff quite a bit. It's interesting. I'm curious, like maybe we'll get to this in a little bit, but working on, you worked on, like you said, rockets at SpaceX and autonomous cars at Zoox, I think. Well, let's just address this now, I guess. What's so important about privacy and collaboration and all of this that sort of convinced you after years of working on things like that, in like the hardware world, to go and focus all of your efforts and all of your energy on starting this company in particular?
It's another really interesting question. I think in many ways they're super similar, where we're basically seeing, this transition to increasingly digital lives, and that's been happening for decades, but I think it's more true now than ever, where we store so much more personal information on our phones or on our laptops than anywhere in the physical world, than in our wallets or in our homes or in our cupboards. And so I think it just feels like we're almost at this decision point where we can either have a world that preserves and protects those freedoms in the digital world. So we have communication products and social media products and news products that respect kind of these fundamental rights that we like to think we have in the physical world. Like people don't know everything about you. They can't search your house on demand. They can't, look at everything that you write and you say to other people on demand. And basically, we can either build those into the digital world or we cannot. And I think that is just a pretty strong mandate for me personally, having worked on all sorts of deep challenges in human safety and autonomous vehicles, and also just spending time abroad. And Jake, I don't know if you've worked in other countries or you've had so many international guests, but just having the experiences of being in other places and thinking about where your data is going and who has access to it, I think it made me really think that the freedoms and the privacy that we can build into the products we use are really special.
Yeah, it's interesting. I didn't put that together previously, but just hearing you talk about it, it actually does seem like there is a common thread between, like rockets, autonomous cars, and email and collaboration. And that sounds like it's safety, basically. And obviously, it's like, informational safety, or I guess it could become physical safety if information becomes sort of a physical threat. But obviously, much more physical in like the rockets and car space. But safety nonetheless, and seems like something that you're certainly passionate about. When you talk about, seeing what's going on internationally and that being a part of the inspiration, I understand that actually a seed of the idea for Skiff or some part of it came to you on a bus ride in Siberia. Can you talk about, how you came up with the idea in the first place and why that sort of international perspective helped inspire what you're doing today?
Yeah, so this was actually around the end of 2021. So before COVID, before the pandemic, but still a really
End
interesting
of
time for,
end
sorry,
of
end of 2021.
2019.
Oh, 2019, you're right. End of 2019.
Time flies.
Oh my gosh, yeah. So yeah, end of 2019, I had graduated from Stanford. I was basically on this kind of graduate student exchange trip to Russia. And I was basically trying to collaborate and work together with people all over the world, people who were on that trip, who we were doing some research together with, colleagues back home, and just on my own personal projects and information. And I think, you know, the context of being in another country as opposed to just another zip code made me really think about the devices I use, the, you know, what's going on, how is my information transmitted across the internet. And I was definitely an early adopter of Signal a few years back and reasonably familiar with the private email space. And so I think I just, as an engineer, got very kind of personally obsessed with that problem. And so then, you know, being in around the world, you know, in Russia and working with people and thinking about time zones and internet service providers and, you know, undersea cables and where all your data is going, just made me want to do much more of a technical deep dive. You know, how is our data transmitted? How is it stored? Who has access to it? And then just kind of seeing this whole private ecosystem evolve. So we see private search engines, private browsers, private messaging apps, private everything, private social media apps. And I think for me personally, just working on the future of work in that context was really meaningful and really exciting. And then just also kind of very personally impactful, where I didn't know at the time, but it's so common. You know, Skip has people we work with in so many different countries every day. And, you know, families communicate across borders and friends talk to each other across all these different, you know, cables and ISPs all the time. And so I think it's a problem that just feels like it's only getting larger and that there's just a far broader consumer awareness of.
Right. And going back to part of what you had said previously, I thought was really interesting. I think I'd read something that you wrote along these lines as well. I always, you know, subscribe to the idea that like the future is not set in stone and we can do things to change the trajectory. And, you know, of course, in a lot of cases, it's difficult for one person to do that or, you know, even a group of people to do that. But there are certainly people who do it, and there are groups and teams and companies who do it. And I think that right now you mentioned like we're at an interesting time where we're shifting extremely fast into this digital world where we had previously spent, you know, most of our time, all of our time, you know, in the physical world, and what that digital world looks like and what the defaults are and how it's built and how privacy is built in or is not built in is sort of, you know, it's undetermined. It's up for grabs. And so you have like a very sort of narrow time to try to sort of impact that and move things in a more privacy forward direction. How do you think about, before we get into like how Skiff is actually, you know, playing a role there, just how do you think about the development of like the digital world and what a future could look like sort of on both sides of the extreme, in a world where that privacy isn't built in versus a world where things develop more accordingly with what you're trying to do with Skiff?
That's tough. I think we're seeing privacy become a necessity across the tech industry. So you know, many of your viewers and we both have probably seen Apple's iPhone privacy campaign. So you'll see them basically marketing the new iPhone as, you know, privacy is kind of a banner leading feature. Mm-hmm. And interestingly, around the world, you'll see the same from Samsung and you'll see it from, you know, Android and Google in certain contexts. And so basically, I think privacy has become a necessity in the US and the EU and just in general. That said, I think the technical form that takes is super variable and all over the place. So in some cases, you'll see that, you know, from Apple, they basically had a multi-year campaign around, you know, email proxying and hide my email and password management and the way photos are stored and all this stuff. And I think in others, you'll see it more as a marketing technique or an adjustment to privacy policies or a commitment to just some sort of, I don't know, marketing campaign almost. And I think that's generally really, really exciting because it also means that we see these private search engines and web browsers and messaging apps take off. But I think it's also this turning point where we could see privacy just kind of be done lip service by governments and by big tech, or we could see, you know, a combination of consumer pressure, new regulation, and just kind of corporate necessity in these, I don't know, in competitiveness to basically make sure that this becomes a real push. I don't know, what are your thoughts? And have you seen any of those ads around the world or any of those campaigns?
Yeah, I've seen the ads and I get, you know, it sort of resonates what you're saying, that privacy is important as a headline for everyone, but what's actually behind the scenes and how private the thing actually is versus paying lip service is not only unclear, but also very difficult to understand for people, you know, unlike you who don't have like the technical, background to look into things and understand like, okay, what's actually going on behind the scenes here. And so for me, like, basically I care about privacy. I think it's very important, but if I'm being realistic, I sort of, it's not my number one priority, right? If there's like a 2 out of 10 product that I can use for, pick whatever as my phone, right? Like as my iPhone or whatever. I'm being like hypothetical, but there's like a 2 out of 10 product that's just like really terrible to use. And, but it's totally private. Everything I do, every note I take, every text I send, whatever. And then there's an 8 out of 10 product and they do the marketing around privacy. What they're actually doing is like a 5 out of 10 on privacy. Just being realistic, I'm going for the 8 out of 10 product because I use this thing every day, several hours, whatever. And it's just people are practical and sort of make these trade-offs. And so I think one of my concerns is that privacy sort of sneaks up on people as this thing that everyone cares about in theory, but people don't care about enough in practice, like myself included. And in a world that goes fully digital, I think it can be hard to appreciate just exactly like what the cost is. Like there's certain things you do and you don't realize the cost until later, and it's too late to put the genie back in the bottle at that point. So, I mean, certainly I've tried to build this brand and this podcast and everything pseudonymously. So there's obviously some, privacy thinking behind that. And that's a good example because it's one of those things where when you start out, on Twitter or doing a podcast or whatever it is, no one cares who you are. You have no followers. No one reads what you're writing. No one listens to your podcasts. But if you aspire to develop a brand and, grow a following of some sort, then eventually, theoretically, people will be following you and will be, they'll be seeing your identity if you're sharing your identity. And so I had to sort of think from day one, like, well, if it's going to be too late to put the genie back in the bottle at that point, and I do seek to, build a brand of some sort, I need to start that from day one, even though it's like actually kind of harder to build a brand without a face and things like this. So it's something that's in my mind. I'm not on like the far end of privacy conscious people by any means, but I'm probably 70% there or something like that, and hoping that people like you come and build good tools and sort of make them just as good to use. Like going back to my 2 out of 10 and 8 out of 10 phone example, if they're 2 8 out of 10 products and one of them is blatantly better at privacy, I'll opt for that one. And it seems like Skiff, it's still very early days, but playing around with it seems just as friendly as Notion. Email seems basically better than Gmail, from like a UX perspective. And so I'm hopeful that people like you will sort of build in the right defaults into society that makes it like a default private world.
Yeah, you hit the nail on the head. I really appreciate that. I mean, I think you also said it perfectly, which is my general take is that I think no 2 out of 10 products can really succeed today, or at least succeed at scale. And regardless of any other wingdings or features you add on, privacy being one of them, I just think bad products are unusably bad. And in certain ways, we are doing everything we can to make Skiff the best product possible. Really simple, intuitive, easy to use, easy to log in. It works on all your devices. It is a similar workflow to products you understand, similar design system, all that stuff. But we also experience bugs that I understand would make people just, very frustrated. So if an app doesn't load, or it loads much more slowly, or it feels like you're getting a subpar experience, people just won't use your product. And I think the world we're trying to get to is like the one you said, basically, which is where, our product, or we're living in this kind of this ecosystem of 8 out of 10 plus, where all the products you can choose from are really good, and then some of them are private. And I think privacy can become a really strong tiebreaker in that sense. But it seems like we're generally on the same page with that, and hopefully we're getting more to that point.
Yeah, so let's talk a bit about what you guys have actually built here. It's been, like you said, I guess we're just over 2 years since I think you founded the company Q1 2020, just when COVID was starting to hit in the US at least. And I mentioned at the top of the show, I started, my first interaction with Skiff was maybe a couple of months ago. I was, using the Pages app for, or the Pages product for basically like a GDocs type experience, commenting on like a blog or something like that, like a drafted blog post. And then I, since in the last couple of days went on, and it's a whole different thing. You guys have mail. There's a G Drive equivalent, but obviously, in a privacy first way. So it's sort of like those three main products, which very loosely are like Gmail, GDocs, and G Drive. I'd say the GDocs is, your guys' Pages product is more akin to Notion, which in my opinion, like both of those are better than GDocs and just more pleasant. You can, do tables and subpages and all these things like that. It's more comfortable for me at least. So how did those things like sort of come about? Because when I had seen it just a couple of months ago, it was just Pages.
So I think generally the Skip mission is to empower people to collaborate, to communicate, and to work together more freely and more creatively. And so in that sense, I think going beyond just written collaboration and notes was supernatural and always part of the picture. Also, I'd say the way we had architected things technically, if you actually think about what goes into building a collaborative product, a lot of those things carry over really nicely to a Drive product and to our mail products, from text editing to sending things to multiple people to building an end-to-end encryption. A lot of the fundamental tech and the privacy was basically built in from the start. So I think building an email product and a Drive product aligned so deeply with our mission. And also, I think with the way people just communicate and collaborate online today. We use our mail inbox to store attachments, which basically function like a Drive product where I'm sure we all have attachments from years ago that we need to keep searching for. And we're constantly messaging documents and notes back and forth and meetings and colleagues. And so basically, people more and more are looking to have an all-in-one ecosystem of products they use. And you see that in all the products you mentioned expanding to offer more, an all-in-one workspace or a whole suite of products for you and your organization. And basically, it just became more and more of a necessity to think about how we can kind of cover more people's use cases and then also introduce them those use cases to privacy. And yeah, I'd say that's a start. I don't know. Any where do you think's the most interesting part to dig into? The technical side or the strategy or what are your thoughts?
I guess for me, the strategy probably of starting with Docs and going to email and Drive, just as like one small thing that I was thinking about, anyone who creates an email with you guys, and I understand a lot of people have since you just recently launched, their address is, their email address is at skiff.com. And that's like sort of like free advertising in a way, where people start to get all these emails instead of, slowly but surely you're getting less emails from at gmail.com or at whoever's website.com and more from at Skiff. And there's this whole sort of network effect of if you're working in the Pages, or you're sharing a file, you're inviting people into the platform. And one thing I think that's pretty cool about what you guys are doing is basically that the whole thing is very usable and very functional as a free product. And you only really have to start paying for it if you want. Sort of if you bump into the wrong limit, like, you want to share this with X number of people, or you want to do this and that, then you might have to pay for the pro plan or whatever. But I think it's, just comparing it to like Notion or something, it's a lot more useful before you have to pay. So I guess over, that's a lot to download maybe, but just your overall thoughts on strategy and if any of those pieces have sort of been intentional and thought out.
Definitely. I guess I'll split it my thoughts into two categories. One, I think, is the business strategy. Other is just the product vision and the company vision. So in the business strategy sense, email has some really strong context, like the one you're talking about, which is the virality of having an at skiff.com. I think the benefit to people who like getting the email address that they want, like if you could get jake@skiff.com, I make no promises, but
I tried that. I tried that. I couldn't get it, but I tried.
Yeah, so we're rolling out shorter email aliases shortly, but basically the value of getting the email address you want is really high to people. You can kind of get a little more ownership over your identity and sharing with other people, like you said, the at skiff.com, the email signature, the extra storage space you can get by referring people. there's just these really strong benefits to having an email product that people like, because then they can, you know, share with their friends, they can get more value out of it, and they can have an email address that they, you know, that's much better than some first name, last name, and six numbers at gmail.com or something. So that's one way we were thinking about it. I think on the vision side, email also just more and more is just such a private corpus of our lives. And tell me if you disagree, but I think it's up there with messaging or anything else. You know, we have years of family records and medical PDFs and education and everything else, jobs. And so I think it just is really intuitive. It hits the nail on the head when you think, where is my most private information? And a lot of it will come back to your email. And so kind of getting people to understand why Skiff Mail is useful to them. And it's because we basically, as Skiff, have no access to anything that people share or write or communicate. And that just made a lot of sense. But what are your thoughts?
Yeah, no, I definitely agree. Lots of sensitive stuff over email, particularly, you know, companies emailing things internally and things like that. I'm curious, have you sort of intentionally, at least not started with, if not entirely avoided, the more, you know, non-email messaging space like WhatsApp and Signal? Obviously, there's already products in that space that are working, whereas, like, I know WhatsApp, I use WhatsApp, I know Signal, I use Signal. I don't use a privacy preserving email. I don't, you know, I use Notion, I use GDocs for pages. So these are, and same with Drive. So these are areas where, like, you guys are offering a private alternative to something that I currently use a non-private product for, whereas the messaging would be just sort of like, you'd probably need like a pretty strong suite that someone's already using in order to like convince them to come on and use your messaging as well. But did you think about maybe going for a product like that in the early days, or how'd you navigate that?
I think we had a pretty strong personal connection to building more of a workspace product, just in my personal background and our CTO's personal background in, you know, communicating and collaborating across borders and thinking a lot about that. But I think we could also, we definitely thought about the context of private messaging too, because in some ways, you know, think about the future of email. Email could end up looking a little more like messaging or feel a little less formal 5 years from now. And so we see that in some of the email prototypes, from Gmail inbox, which I think is shut down at this point, from Heymail, and just from other email products that are out there. So it's definitely something we're thinking about. Generally, I'll also say, I think there's just really good products in that space. We've worked with the CTO of Signal as an advisor and gotten some help from other people on their team. They are just an excellent product that I think has led the way in a lot of the algorithmic design around end-to-end encryption, with end-to-end encrypted video calls and group messaging and all sorts of things. And so I think they've just done a really fantastic job on building a product. And so in thinking about what we're kind of uniquely excited about and also uniquely good at, you know, building Skiff as a workspace product made a lot of sense. But, you know, the strategy is interesting too. Like, with messaging, you can get such strong network effects once people start to adopt your product, but have such immense kind of startup challenges, as, you know, it's you in an echo chamber of not a lot of people on your that product today. And I think we've seen that. Like, I imagine, you know, if you've been on Signal for a few years, you probably have gotten a lot more of those, "My friend is on Signal now" today, than, you know, a year and a half ago.
Yeah, no, definitely. And I like those products. I mean, they're, like I said earlier, like we talked about, you know, they're 8 out of 10, and there's no reason not to use them from my perspective. I still end up using SMS for whatever reason, but, you know, with certain messages, but basically anything that's like important is on those now. And I think there's basically no trade-off. So sort of speaking of the, you know, trade-off situation and people going from potentially one product to another, we talked a little bit offline about, you know, just the stickiness of people getting comfortable with whatever products they use for work, especially, and, you know, convincing them that it's worthwhile to shift over to Skiff, whether it's for, you know, from Notion to Skiff for pages, or Gmail to Skiff for mail, or ideally all of the above. I'm curious, like, on the one hand, what sorts of things you guys have done to try to make that an easier transition and sort of remove friction from the process for people. And then secondarily, I don't know if you have insights into this, but like, where people are coming from mostly. Like, I imagine on mail, it's probably mostly Gmail just because of how dominant it is. But are you sort of in the early days converting most people from like other, end-to-end encrypted email services and providers, or how's that looking in terms of like where people are coming from?
Yeah, these are great questions. I think on the first, on basically switching costs, how do you get someone to consider using a new product and eventually make it their main product? There are large things that you can do to just build into a product and make that possible. So what I mean by that is, you can build in automated migration tools. So in Skift today, you can basically connect your Gmail, or sorry, connect your Google Drive and download in all your documents and soon all of your other files. And then, later your Gmail and import existing mail. And so you can make it easier for people to not have to kind of parallelize multiple things at once if they already, are interested in switching. So I think that's the first. The second is a bit of a pitch. I know you have a pretty strong technical audience. So it's one of the most technical, immense technical challenges I think that's out there, which is email, Docs, Collaboration, Drive. They're products people that use every day, and in some cases for hours every day. You could check your email every single hour you're awake. And so you're basically exposing yourself to an extremely challenging product surface area. Like, how's the refresh animation? How are the swipe animations? How are the scroll animations? How's the load to refresh? How's the in-app mobile experience? How's the typing experience? How's the latency in the editor? And so I think all of those things start to compound when you're dealing with a scale of, basically people using a product many, many times per day. And that's something we are just working on all the time. How do we make that easier for people to transition? How do we make our product better? And, how can we, if you use Skift for 6 hours, how can we make sure that experience is perfect? What was your second question?
Well, I'll bring back up the second question if I can remember it. I think I have it, but I want to go further on that point for a second. When you think about sort of these experiences, people spending, several hours on most of these apps, whether it's on their phone or on their computer in a given workday, obviously you have various models to look at, whether it's Gmail, Notion, or the like. But were there things you just rattled off like a pretty impressive list of things that people care about and sort of features that people maybe don't think about unless you're building them, and but that they do appreciate and recognize and make the experience better and everything. I'm curious if there's anything in particular that comes to mind where you decided to differentiate from what was sort of best in class to try to actually do something even a little bit better than what people are used to.
That's a great question. I think we definitely have a really strong design culture. Our CTO, Jason, is a designer and I think has always basically done things from the ground up. So it's never been look at Google or look at Notion. It's, what is the 30-year evolution in text editing and email, and how can we build a product that's great? And so you'll see things like, Skift is a single page design. It's not paginated, and you see kind of Google moving in that direction, and obviously Notion and Evernote and others already there. A lot of that is because people just don't really print their things anymore. And so Jason could give you a whole history about, typography and printing and where that movement is going. But I think you would see that in our product in a lot of ways. And so a few examples that come to mind, just some of the things we think about are like badging in the products, around end-to-end encryption and security. So making it clear when a document or an email or a person you're talking to, just like you'd see on Signal or on WhatsApp, you'll see something when you start a new email or conversation that, shows you something about security. I think we also, in thinking through those things I talked about with like attachment storage and the privacy and attachments and the privacy and sharing files, we thought a lot about, having a distinct page in the email app where you could look at all of your previous attachments. And so I think that, both carries through on this theory that we have of building a drive product where people can store and share files, but also that a lot of your personal files and data are stored in your email. And so that's another direction we've gone. I think finally, you'll see this in the product over the next couple months, but it's building a really cohesive integrated workspace. And so all those workflows I talked about some time ago, you're writing something in an email thread, you want to create a document, you're sharing a document, or you're working together on, in real time or asynchronously, you're going through comment workflows. A lot of those you can just see build layers and layers on top, inside an ecosystem. So like really rich notifications, really good back and forth, really good mobile apps. And so I think, something we are working towards more and more is just a really integrated workspace. I don't know, does that cover it? I think I skipped over all the tiny things you'll see, like load time and, the refresh animations and swipes and scrolls, but I'm happy to go into excruciating detail there because a lot of that I think is where you go from the 2 out of 10 you're talking about of just a new product that exists to like the 8 out of 10 or the 9 out of 10 from the products that a billion people use today.
Yeah, no, that was a great answer. I think you can trust sort of when you see that people are doing the little things right, that the big things will sort of work themselves out. And you guys are obviously thinking like extremely deeply about this. It sounds like your co-founder is extremely design oriented. And actually, to that point, I think he's pretty technical as well, right? You guys mentioned you sort of co-led the hackathon at Stanford. What's it been like? What are the advantages, I guess, of having two technical co-founders? Because it's not always that way. And how do you guys sort of play off each other? It sounds like he's a bit more design forward, and maybe you cover more of like sort of the business end. I'm curious, like sort of how that pairing has worked early on, and how you guys sort of play off each other's strengths and weaknesses.
That's also super interesting, and I think has changed a lot. And I wish I had understood exactly how that would evolve over years. But I'd say, first of all, having two technical co-founders, I think, is a big strength. Like at the end of the day, if something's broken in the middle of the night, we're responsible, as the CEO and CTO of the company. And there was a point where we were the only employees in the company. And so we are both, I think, or at least like to think we are more than capable of fixing things, in a moment of crisis, or something really needs to get redone or tested or explored, we'll both jump in immediately. And so I think that's a big advantage, especially in a really small early company where, you may not have as reliable a team, you may have really limited funding, and just having two people who are completely aligned and ready to build something together is huge. And so we would just code all day. I think more and more, you're right that actually that design mindset more than the technical mindset has started to guide things, where we need to make the right decisions about how is the product going to look, what features are we going to build, because there's such a mode of, you're building a consumer product and feature creep is the death of your product or company, and you're not actually getting further enough to, build something that people definitely want. So I'd say more and more Jason thinks about, what are we building, what is the design, how is the product evolving to get to that 8 out of 10 plus. And a lot of more what I do is I'm still very involved in engineering, but also with a lot of the partnerships we do. We're collaborating with crypto companies and privacy companies, and then oftentimes doing a lot of engineering based on that. Changing the way our product, you sign up for our product or onboard onto our product or the integrations with our product. And so I think we're both super involved with the engineering team, but I'd say overall, if you want a 2-year roadmap on, where the product is going, I think you better talk to Jason and get some design perspective.
Yeah, no, it's really interesting. It sounds like a great pairing so far, for sure. You mentioned the crypto partners and everything like that. It's very obvious when you go to the website that you guys are crypto forward. When I went and signed up using my MetaMask wallet. I think you can do it with Phantom for people who like Solana more, and a few other wallets as well. What was, I think you guys probably could have built what you're doing without leaning heavily on, like, you didn't need to offer MetaMask sign-in and these various different integrations with crypto, but you decided to do so nonetheless. I'm curious, why crypto basically? And I imagine that you're sort of optimistic about where the space is headed, but why did it become like a natural integration, not just like something to think about down the line, but something to really lean on in the early days?
Well, I'll give you the kind of answer in terms of how we think about it in relation to the mission, and I'd love to hear what you think, because I'm
Sure.
sure it's come up a lot more in the last 6 months than the 6 months prior, or maybe it started to peak. But basically, I think we think about how it intersects with our core mission to let, enable people to work together and collaborate and communicate more freely and privately and effectively. And so when you think about that, crypto, I think, aligns so well with privacy in many ways, like your keys, your data, owning your, wallet. And a wallet is just a private key, just like, an encrypted email address. And so at the end of the day, the technical intersections are really high. Everyone who has a crypto wallet has a private key, and everyone who has a Skiff account has a private key. Why not connect them? And I think also just ideologically, they're really aligned. People in crypto want to own their own data. They want to exist or like work with systems that are kind of free from human interference and intervention. And so, with decentralized storage and private custody of your, tokens or NFTs or your information, owned by your hardware wallet, I think there's just such a deep sense of ownership in the crypto ideology that overlaps so well with how we think about privacy and data ownership as well. So that's how we think about it. And, you know, happy to talk in more detail about the individual wallets or the storage or other components of that. So I think this is one of the most interesting things we do at Skip.
Yeah, for sure. I mean, go ahead and sort of like keep going on the point. I guess I'll sort of help direct a little bit. Like, you know, right now you can sign in with MetaMask and you get like an email that's basically your ETH address at skiff.com. And I think the storage for the files is on IPFS. And like, there's maybe some other integrations that I'm not aware of. But do you foresee anything in particular that you can talk about today in terms of sort of, you know, doubling down on that integration with crypto and pairing? I totally agree with what you said. You know, like there's a lot of natural alignment there. So I'm curious how you're sort of going about putting it into practice.
Definitely. And I think that you hit on the main points, and I'll talk about some of the things we see coming up. So the main premise in just building a MetaMask login, for example, which was one of the first crypto related elements of Skiff, is just that a MetaMask wallet is just like a private key. You know, it's basically something you can use for signing data. So like we sign a transaction, or for encrypting, decrypting, and proving you have access to something. And so that's basically how Skiff functions. You know, you're sending an end-to-end encrypted email or message to someone, or encrypting a file or a document that you want to keep online. And so using a MetaMask wallet, all of a sudden with the kind of flip of a switch, gives 30, 40 more million people every month who use MetaMask access to a way to collaborate and work together and communicate with that same wallet, that same private key, and that same identity. And so I think that's so cool, and also just so optimistic for the future. You know, for those who follow the history of private email with PGP and all these ways of sharing keys, we've basically been trying to get people access to more private keys for decades. And so if crypto and crypto wallets is one way of doing that, we are super optimistic. And so then I'll just kind of jump into the other product sides of this. You mentioned decentralized storage. Well, decentralized storage, you know, for certain people is super compelling, because you can basically publish, you know, your thesis or a blog and then just have it stored on a network that could exist forever. And I think IPFS has nodes in space. They have nodes in, you know, probably over 100 countries and just basically petabytes of storage on the network. And so if you want to publish something to a network like that, Skiff is a user-friendly, simple, and end-to-end encrypted way of doing that. And I think that's something where we're kind of connecting the dots. So you go from, you know, MetaMask to a private key to end-to-end encryption, which you need some sort of private key for. And then now that you have end-to-end encryption, you can do decentralized storage. You can store it on a network that exists around the globe. And you can get a lot of those benefits of, you know, if someone doesn't want their data stored on a data center, they can use IPFS. And so we think about it almost as these dominoes of reaching more people, bringing more utility, and also just aligning with the core Skiff mission. And yeah, happy to go into more detail on any of those as well.
Yeah, I really like the sound of that. And just to sort of clarify one point on the IPFS, I'm, you know, admittedly somewhat ignorant on the subject, but it sounds like, you know, you'd mentioned, obviously there's the privacy aspect of not storing it with Google or whatever. But it sounds like there's another aspect which I hadn't thought about as much of, like, if you're storing it in a decentralized manner, it's more, you know, everlasting, basically, because, you know, that's like one of the whole issues with centralization. Obviously, there's like the censorship issue when it comes to social media, but there's also like the risk that the centralized entity no longer exists in X number of years. Is that sort of infinite storage a part of the compelling nature there?
It definitely is to us. And I think it depends on your work style or what you work on that will make that more or less compelling. Like if you're, you know, you're working on publishing something that you want to exist forever, that will matter to you. Also just, you know, as a future topic of exploration, there are a bunch of different decentralized storage networks now beyond just IPFS, and they all have really different properties around these questions, like for ideological reasons, for, you know, network reasons, like the network wants the ability to remove or to delete things. So basically a bunch of people are working on decentralized storage, all I think with the same mindset of we want the ability to have censorship resistant networks that live around the world, and they have different properties of things existing permanently or, you know, for some time, and how you pay for it and all that kind of stuff. So it's super active in development and in crypto in general.
Right. And so with that, was there any in particular reason why you went with IPFS, at least for now?
That's also a great question. I think largely just from the team and relationships we had, they have a really large, stable, and growing developer community. And so we got to know just some of the developers and dev tooling that exists there, like hosting pages on IPFS, hosting data, you know, having JavaScript, Python, Go, and other libraries to interact with their networks. And so I think it was just the maturity of the, you know, the developer product and the tooling and the community there that was really compelling to us. And so we got more and more involved with that, you know, exposure to more of their team, more people who develop in the community and in their open source projects. And so I think just, you know, working with the team and the community was the biggest thing in, you know, getting us to build IPFS into our product, which of course is awesome because we were looking at them as a developer product.
Yeah, no, that makes sense. I remembered the second part of that question from earlier that we trailed away from. So I'll go back and ask that one. Where are people coming into Skiff from? Like, are they leaving a Gmail address behind, or they're leaving Notion behind, right, or they're coming from more, you know, privacy oriented emails and you're targeting more of like sort of that niche audience, or at least nicher audience from day one?
Yeah.
Where are people coming from?
It's definitely both. I'd say, well, with Gmail's, let's say 3 billion plus users, I think most people on the internet have had some exposure to it. Just generally, people who are exposed to a privacy-focused email provider or messaging app, they tend to be, you know, more engaged users, more engaged in the product or community, or, you know, asking us more questions. And so we definitely see that, just because I think they ideologically understand or are researching this space more. But we have plenty of users who just come to us and say, I'm looking for a Gmail alternative. I've had this experience or this frustration, and, you know, I'm looking to move on. So it's definitely a mix, but I'd say people who come from experience in the privacy community tend to either engage more or know more about the product, or, you know, have more feedback for us or interact more.
Yeah, no, that makes sense. So zooming out a little bit and on a very related point, I think, and maybe we'll make this the last question, but, you know, certain people, like on that point of where they're coming from, certain people are coming from more privacy oriented services. Others are coming from, you know, general public. They're moving from Gmail or Notion, and they didn't, you know, use privacy forward products in those realms previously, but now they want to because they care about privacy. But basically, like, there's a whole world of people. And, you know, like you said, Gmail has captured billions of them, or Google's captured billions of them. And, you know, they may or may not be open to switching and whatnot. But basically, there's a bunch of people who care about privacy, you know, a lot. And then there's some who are, you know, 7, 8 out of 10 on the spectrum, sort of like I am. Maybe I'm underestimating myself. I am sort of doing this thing pseudonymously. I might be closer to a 9 or 9.5 or something. But, you know, regardless, there's a whole spectrum. And like, there's somewhat limited number of people, I imagine, at the far end on the privacy side. And then the mainstream sort of lives somewhere in the middle. So I'm curious how you think about, like, you know, on the one hand, showing all the people who care about privacy, you don't have to convince that privacy is important and more than just a billboard, like it's actually, you need the real deal. And there's sort of those people who are like the easier targets for you guys. But then there's a whole world of people who, like, sort of loosely understand, you know, privacy is important, but don't really care that much or whatever. And I'm curious, like, how much you've thought about approaching that overall market, and maybe starting with the people who care more and eventually convincing people, you know, why they need to care and things like that. Just any thoughts you have on sort of like that long-term vision of bringing this to, you know, a billion people or whatever it might be.
Yeah, I think my overall take on the market is, I think that people generally bias towards caring, or at least say they're caring. But I think, like you said, they have, you know, very little energy or understanding or opportunity to do something about it. And so I think those people are really the people we need to almost connect most deeply with at Skiff. And I guess to share a little more about that, you know, the people who already love privacy, they should be great users for us. You know, I think we've built a lot of our product and our brand and our mission around connecting to them, you know, our privacy policy, our product, our blogs, the whole technical background, the open sourcing, all sorts of stuff there. But I also think that there's almost a bifurcation where you can either dig more and more into certain privacy features that only a few people will use. Like if we built, you know, certain types of encryption integrations into our product, or, you know, basically certain features that not everyone would use, but maybe a small, really privacy fanatic group of people would, I think we could actually end up losing out more on those people who are those 5 out of 10s. They think privacy is important, but they don't really know what to do about it. And I think, you know, the much kind of more important thing for us is to be that 8, 9, 10 out of 10 product And then to compete head to head with privacy and owning your own data and protecting, you know, all your personal information is one of the biggest differentiating elements of Skift. And I think, you know, we had to build that in from the ground up. That had to be our core mission and vision because it's really different than the way things exist today. But I think the most important thing for us is being a product that, you know, everyone can use and benefit from and can really easily understand. And I don't know, what are your thoughts on that? I think, do you feel like that is a different strategy? Do you think that's doable? What do you think?
Yeah, no, I think I was just going to say, I mean, you mentioned like ideally we become the 8 out of 10, 9 out of 10 product, and you don't have to choose between privacy and sort of having a pleasant experience. You get both. And I think you guys are well on your way to that. You know, I encourage anyone who's listening who sounds at all interested in what we're talking about here, you know, go to skift.com, check it out. It's just like, we could talk about it all day, but you know, play around with the mail, get your email, sign up with MetaMask, whatever, go and make a doc and or a page and you know, see how it compares to whatever you're using for collaboration now. I think that to start like you guys have by focusing not just on the technical back end, but also on the part that users experience and making sure it's competitive with anything else they could use, privacy or otherwise, it's like super important. And there's always going to be switching costs, but at least, you know, making it an apples to apples or better product. They're not switching just for the privacy. They're switching for the privacy and the experience. So I think you guys are, you know, well on your way and looking forward to, using the product more myself and maybe, taking a bite out of the switching costs and making the full move soon. But, Andrew, it's been great talking with you today and appreciate you coming on. I know we're coming up at the top of the hour. In addition to everywhere that I just, you know, told people to go on the website and things like that, anywhere else that you want to point people to follow your journey and Skift as we go forward today?
No, I'd say you really covered it. Thanks so much for having me, Jake. And as you mentioned, skift.com is the best place. And if you'd like to follow us on Twitter, we're also Skift Privacy on Twitter. And if you want direct interaction with everyone on our team, we are also in a Discord and we'll get back to you hopefully within minutes. If you ever have any questions for us.